This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. What do you do when you find someone else's shopping list, love letters, journal entries, scribbled reminders, or ticket stubs? Well, most people would throw them away, but not the creators of Found magazine. They've taken these treasures and turned them into what has become a small industry. Through Found magazine, through a website, they've been giving readers a peek into other people's lives. This has also spawned songs, and now Davy Rothbart, the creator of Found magazine, has come out with a book based on the magazine. We welcome to the show today Peter Rothbart, who is Davy's brother, and folk singer Devin Sproul. Both of our guests write songs that are based on the items found in Found magazine. And we welcome your calls this hour about your finds. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. We'd be curious to hear about those scraps of paper that you've come across and saved, or perhaps the ones you throw away, perhaps to your never-ending regret. Also, is this art, or is it a kind of visual eavesdropping? The number, once again, is 1-877-962-9862. Well, welcome, Peter Rothbart and Devin Sproul.
Thanks, Melinda.
Thank you
Thanks
very
for
much.
Having us.
Well, this book is edited by your brother, Davy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But he's not here today. Because
no, he had some health issues, so he's taking a week off of the tour that we're currently on. Mm-hmm. So he's back in Ann Arbor.
Okay, which is where you live now.
Yes, yeah, we live in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And this tour, we should say from the start, this is Found magazine is not your standard magazine, and this tour that you're on is not your standard tour, is it?
No, it's a little more extensive. We're going to all 50 states this year. We're doing about 140 cities, so we've been touring since mid-April, and we're continuing till the end of the year.
And this is not just going around and talking about what's in Found magazine and in the book, but it's musical as well.
Right. Our shows usually include it's like a mixed literary and musical event. So we do some readings from the magazine and we have some musical accompaniment. You know, we Devin and I play songs that are based on some of the found notes. And then we also invite people who come to the shows to come up and share some of the stuff that they may have found.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that people are bringing those items to you and they may end up in the magazine? Or
Yes, they're bringing them to us en masse. We get maybe 10 to 20 finds a day.
And Peter will read them, the ones that he's gotten just the night before, which is really exciting. Yeah. People bring in crazy, crazy stuff.
Like what kind of stuff have you gotten recently that people have brought to shows?
Well, the one that comes to mind isn't really radio appropriate.
Okay, so all nature of things. How about one that might be?
Good question. What were we given yesterday? Or what was
in
the one
Charlottesville, which is my hometown and where I started on the tour, a friend brought in an arithmetic book from 1848. And it was these crazy measurements. It was like, if you took a hogshead of rum by the barrel down to the local Sutherland and then cut it and then waited 40 days,
really complex arithmetic problems. And also inside of it, the girl who had owned it had written some poetry and also spelled out her name, written her first and last name in a few different ways, suggesting different boys she might marry and just trying to look at see how her name would appear if she wrote it out after being married to these boys.
This might have been the earliest Math for Poets book that existed. So now, Peter, your brother, I think, has described you within these pages or somewhere that you're the world's greatest finder.
Well, sure. Why not?
Yeah. Now, dumpsters are involved in a lot of this.
Yes. I spent a good deal of my time in college at the University of Michigan dumpster diving, paying my way through college by dumpster diving, digging through trash and pulling out all manner of things and selling them online. And amidst that, I also managed to find a wealth of found treasures, notes and letters and other things like that.
Right. Like this would be the things that you would sell online would be what, books and so forth?
Yeah. Textbooks, electronics, things like that.
But it would be within those pages that you would find the kind of scraps that would end up in found.
Within those pages and also just covering those other items. I mean, when you're digging through a dumpster, there's a lot of space. There's a general litter of found stuff.
How did you get onto this?
How did Found magazine start?
Yeah, how did you come on the idea that other people would be interested in other people's shopping lists?
Well, my brother and I used to always collect found items. When we were walking across, we used to have to walk across this big field to get to the school bus, and And it was sort of a litter-strewn field. We were always finding interesting scraps of paper around there. And my brother especially liked to collect this stuff, and he would hang on to it. And throughout his life, he noticed that other people also had shared that interest with him. And then one day when he was living in Chicago, he came out to his car, and he found a note on it addressed to Mario. And it said, "Mario, I thought you had to work. Why is your car here at her place? I hate you. I hate you. You're a liar. I hate you. P.S. Page me later. Love, Amber." and so it was just this great, such conflicting tones. You know, she's so angry at Mario for cheating on her. Or so it seems. When in reality, of course, it was just my brother's car. But then she also has that little coda at the end. Page me later. And he loved that note so much. He felt like he really wanted to start sharing it with people. So he had the idea to make Found Magazine, and he sent out some flyers to people and you know, calling for people to send in their own finds. Mm-hmm. And it grew from there.
Did he? Now, I know that in reading the book here that you have gotten in touch with some people, mm-hmm. that if you've been able to sleuth out who they are. Did you ever get in touch with, you know, ambivalent Amber in Chicago?
We didn't get in touch with Amber, no. But we have gotten in touch with some people. No. Yes.
And sometimes they'll show up at shows, which is very exciting. Davey's been bringing a found book around and having people sign the book who were the finders of the ones that made it in
right.
the book.
So you know, sometimes we come in touch with, in contact with the people who found the notes. I mean, that's regularly because as we're traveling around, we like to meet a lot of the people who have found stuff. And then also occasionally we get a letter or an email from someone who, you know, whose note we have found. And their reactions are sort of varied. They're interesting.
Now, do some people ever feel as though their world's been pried open for the rest of the world to see?
You know, we weren't sure what to expect from people. We thought people might be upset or angry, but it turns out they're generally just sort of mystified as to why, what interest would someone have in these little, you know, for example, these little minute details of their love life. Like, why would someone care about this letter that I wrote or this picture that I drew? And they're sort of honored in a way, you know. They think it's cool that someone would take enough interest in it.
We're talking with Peter Rothbart, whose brother Davey had founded Found Magazine, and Peter has been inspired by a number of the things that were found there to write songs. With us also is Devin Sproul, a folk singer from Charlottesville, Virginia, and we'll be hearing a song that was inspired in just a moment or two. So you started this magazine, Found Magazine, three years ago, and this was just, it was not a very shiny magazine from the start. It was a Kinko's
yes,
operation.
Kinko's brand or variety.
Just perfect for found stuff. It looks so great. Little edges of the notebook paper yeah. all photocopied on. And
I think when it was started, it would qualify more as a zine. Mm-hmm. And just because it's grown, we still think of it as a zine. You know, I mean, we're still an independent group, and we appreciate the work of independent artists. And so maybe it looks a little shinier because we have it printed professionally now. But I think that's just because we don't want to staple them all together.
Well, how many are you up to now? If you'd have to staple them together, how many subscribers?
There's 30 or 35,000,
wow.
roughly.
In just 3 years' time.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's the number of subscribers. And I think there's a significant number above
yeah.
that actually own or have looked at the
magazine.
Because
they don't, the found magazines, they're a lot of work and they don't take quite as much. They take a lot of time, so they don't come out every month. They come
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah.
Is it quarterly now?
No, it's roughly annually.
It's annually now. Okay. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think we have one of the subscribers on the line here. Stephanie is in Durham. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
Greetings.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I'm a subscriber to Found.
Great.
And I just love it. I devour it when it arrives and pass it along to my friends. And you asked early in the program about whether or not it's art. And I certainly do believe it is. It impacts me the way art should impact someone. It makes me think, makes me go outside myself to imagine other people's lives. And my particular situation, I'm a stay-at-home mom. So in this season of my life, I don't get out much, to say the least. And, you know, I can get on the website about once a week and take a look at things, and it's really an oasis for me. I love it. I especially love the grocery list, maybe because I do a lot of grocery shops. But I remember one in particular where a gentleman needed, like, I assumed it was a gentleman. That's my own bias. But it was, like, bologna, beer, and matches or something.
I think it was meat, bologna, dog food, beer, Senka.
Yeah, that's it. And I love the magazine. I just think it's great work, and I really appreciate that you all put it out.
Well, I'm curious yourself, Stephanie, when you write lists, do you just keep them whole when you throw them away now, or do you
Oh, good question.
With the thinking that somebody may pick this up, or do you put it in your own personal shredder?
You know, I do throw things away, and it's funny. It seems like before I subscribed to Found, it seems like I found things all the time. And now that I would love to find something interesting, it seems like I can't find something.
That's because everyone else is already picking it up.
Because I pick up things all the time thinking, oh, this could be something. And, you know, then I'm disappointed that it's not, you know, the least bit interesting.
Can you give us an example of something you found in past years before Found Magazine was around to amplify it?
Oh, I had this really strange experience. I don't know how it would translate into the magazine, but over a period of about 6 months, I kept finding playing cards, and it was the same card. It was the two of spades, and I found like three of them. And it was the only playing cards I found, and it was just, it was a little strange. It was like God was having some kind of little joke with me that
it's
I didn't
sort of
quite catch. But
it's very ominous,
yeah.
Sort of foreboding.
It could be the start of a good movie.
Yeah.
The Two of Spades, starring, I think, Keanu Reeves would be the star of that one.
Well, Stephanie, thanks so much for your call.
My pleasure. Thank you.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. We are talking with Peter Rothbart and Devin Sproul, who are with Found Magazine. It is on tour. You don't just have a lot of magazines going on tour, but they're on tour. They're here in the studio today. If you have a question or comment about things that you have found that might well at some point end up in the pages of Found Magazine, give us a call. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. More just ahead. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we're talking today about a new book from the people behind Found Magazine. The book is called Found, The Best Lost, Tossed, and Forgotten Items from Around the World. It's written by the magazine's creator, Davey Rothbart. Davey's brother and collaborator, Peter Rothbart, is here with us today, along with singer-songwriter Devin Sproul. Both Peter and Devin have written songs based on notes published in Found Magazine. We're taking your calls as well. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Peter Rothbart, could you give us an example of the kind of notes and letters or scribblings that end up in the pages of Found?
Absolutely. So Found Magazine is just a collection of notes and letters and pictures and just stuff that people send us from all over the country. Actually, we get some stuff from all over the world, really. And here's a good example. This one came to us from Los Angeles, and it says, Jesse, I did not take anything. I know there's no convincing you once you've made up your mind, and although I cannot offer you any other explanation as to what happened to it, that doesn't mean I did it. How could I have? You say your car was locked and Katie had the keys. Anyway, I don't need to take something of yours when I can get my own. It doesn't make sense. But here's a replacement. Because I can't stand it when you think I've wronged you. Mom. and you know she's guilty, too. I mean, I don't even know what she took.
She doth protest too much. Do you have it now in your mind? Did you have a sense of what it was that was taken?
No. It really could be anything if you think about it.
Doesn't sound like the kind of thing a mom would take, whatever it was.
Right.
When she can get her own.
Right.
Here's another great example. And this one, it's just a little scrap of paper. It really shows you something about the economy of language, and it's just this little scrap of paper here, and it looks like a girl who's trying to decide between two different guys. So she does, you know, the only rational thing, which is to write out bad things and good things about each of these guys, Andrew and Paul. So she says, Andrew, crazy. Paul, crazier. Andrew has issues with fat people. Paul's too loud. Andrew's torn between Stacy and I. Paul's too childish. And then the good things. Andrew, I married him. Paul has a great child. Andrew has always been a good friend. Paul has a house. Andrew, sex. Paul, money. So.
There's more of that ambivalence out there, isn't there? We just keep coming across it time and again. But there are people who are emphatic, too, in what they write. And I think of those notes that they're throughout the book, those notes that people leave under windshields. You know, about you've taken my parking space. There's even one who signs off as, what is it, partner in Christ or so on, as after they write their nasty little note to somebody about parking space.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
I am going to heaven because I don't take parking space.
Yeah, we find a lot of letters left on windshields. We find a lot of shopping and grocery lists or to-do lists are also very common. We also find just a lot of sort of baffling and cryptic and weird ones. This one we got on the tour. It was given to us in Alaska. You know, 50 states means 50 states. So, and it just says, it's a sign. It says, no touchy, no bumpy, no movie, no nothing. And we don't really know what to make of that, you know? It could, what is it that shouldn't be touched, bumped, or moved, or anything?
Right. Well, we know how you got involved with Found Magazine, mm-hmm. but Devin, your involvement also has another Found story.
Yeah, literally. It was a little more recently, though. The story that I got an email from Davey, Peter's brother, probably a year and a half, maybe close to 2 years ago, describing him living in New Mexico and driving home one night, and he had this accident that he ended up not being too hurt, but he did have this abrasion on his head, and in his trunk had opened, and this stuff was, the newspaper was flying out. He's clearly a pack rat, and so there's all kinds of stuff in his car. And he put, or whoever had stopped to help him had put this piece of newspaper up against his head. He woke up the next morning, and he still had this piece of paper in his hand that had come off, and it was kind of messy, but he, being the person that he is, took it apart and kind of started looking at it and was kind of laying in bed. And it was an article in the Washington Post magazine about the community or commune in Central Virginia where I grew up. And it is, a little bit of a alternative lifestyle, a bunch of people living together, et cetera, et cetera. And I was probably 16 when the article was written. It was probably a few years old by the time he found it. And I was, had this burgeoning singer-songwriter career that eventually moved to Charlottesville, which is where I am now. And he looked it up after he kind of recuperated and started listening to the music. And eventually, when the Found Tour got put together, he decided that if he was going to go on tour, if he couldn't do it in a helicopter with, fly ladies on either side.
He said he wanted to do it with his two favorite musicians,
and that was Peter and myself. Right. And this was all in this email that he wrote to me. And at first I thought, and the nice part was he mentioned, I get a few fan letters from people who are less than just a little weird, a little bit. So he had mentioned in the PS, he said, I need to get back my girlfriend and I, blah, 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 blah. And that was very considerate of him because it wasn't a sleazy note. It was very honest and wonderful. And I didn't think it was going to work out at first, honestly, because I do get a fair amount of stuff like that. But it ended up working out, and Peter and Davey and I went on tour for 6 weeks, I believe it was, last summer. We did the West Coast, and we came down through Charlottesville, and I got to show off the Rothbart brothers to my friends in Charlottesville. And so when they do the Found Audio project, and they asked me to write a song for it, and so I took 3 or 4 notes, and which are, I think they're all up on the website, foundmagazine.com, and I have some commentary on the notes. And I wrote this song called Julie.
And give us a little bit about the origins of Julie. This Julie was derived from yet another piece of Found writing.
The original note, the note that I took the most material from, was a note that was left on a windshield. And it said, he's clearly very self-conscious. He says, I see your plates are from Colorado. I knew a girl from Colorado. Could this be you, Julie? This isn't like me to leave a note. Clearly, we're lucky that he did that anyway. And this is, extremely out of character. I hope I haven't made you uncomfortable. But if you are my Julie, could you call this number? And there are a few other notes that I took very choice, wonderful phrases from. But that was the main idea behind it. And I just thought it was charming. And It just these notes are just so moving. You can relate to them on one hand. On the other hand, it feels like an alien's writing them. It's such a human connection. It's really
indeed. And so this inspired the song, Julie.
It did. It did. I was on a walk tonight out late. I noticed your Volvo license plate, a horseless carriage from Colorado, the home state of a pretty girl I used to know. We met in a computer lab where I introduced myself. She was pre-med, I was nervous as hell. Her name was Julie, could yours be the same? I'm leaving this note on your windshield just in case. Both shy and a little strange. We both like spiders and good guy, bad guy trains. Her lips were chapped, her shoulders burned. We moved in together just after the winter turned. Julie always left a little light on for me. She said there was little that she still I noticed all the time she clenched her teeth and the nights when she barely touched her drink. Julie, 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 all along there was something wrong. But in my last letter to Julie, I scrawled that I wasn't the guy who dialed that fatal call. Up in the gallery, I cried as the jury decided to keep me from my beautiful love, my unlucky lady, the only girl I think of. So perhaps you're not the one I held so dear. Why should I believe she would ever return here? I just can't keep from looking for her along these streets. I just keep looking, looking around for Julie. Something wrong.
Devin Sproul and Julie, which was inspired by something that was sent into Found magazine.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And of course, you took it beyond that because the original letter to Found was from a man who had met this woman once and was taken a chance by...
Some of the stuff was taken from a much more fanciful love letter, the shoulder, burned shoulders and the chapped lips, and there was a wonderful note, spiders and trains, that line, which I'm particularly fond of, was from. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you ever, now, Peter Rothbart, you and your brother have been putting together Found magazine and this book and the whole operation. Have you ever gotten in touch with either Julie or the man who wrote that original letter?
Unfortunately, no. But what's interesting about the note, the note from the guy in Fayetteville, I think it was found in Fayetteville, Arkansas, the guy who's writing about this girl, Julie, is at the bottom of it.
Oh, yeah.
At the bottom of it, it actually says, if you're not Julie... then you can send this note into Found Magazine, which is, and that's the
it
first
says,
time.
It says, because it will be accepted. I'm looking at it right here. He says, P.S., if you're not Julie, then you should send this to Found Magazine because it will be accepted.
Yeah, that's the first note we've ever received that actually mentioned Found Magazine in it, and I thought that was great.
I wonder if that's life imitating found art. <laughs> <laughs> You know? Now, that gets to a question of how do you know that everything is real, that people, that there could be people out there now who are writing these very fanciful, beautiful sonnets, even in scribbled form.
Right.
How do you know that they're not hoaxes?
It's a good question. The first thing is that the reward to effort ratio is very small. You know, if you were to try and forge a found item, you'd first of all have to spend the time to think of something interesting, and then you'd have to crumple up the paper and get it wet and, you know, do all that business and then send it into us and then hope that it was one of the, you know, that one of the very few things that actually makes it into the magazine.
They get 15 to 20 things sent in per day.
But so. I think Stephanie earlier, our caller, made a very good point just talking about it being sort of an art project. And one of the great things about this project is that people who submit stuff, they aren't submitting their own work. There's no ego involved in it, you know? So someone doesn't stand to gain much by making up a found note and sending it into us. Even if it gets published, it's we're not recognizing them, you know. We're recognizing the found item and the original authors of it.
Unless, of course, it shows up on somebody's resume.
Yeah, but I think that most people who enjoy Found Magazine or who are a part of the project just wouldn't be interested in that sort of forgery.
And if you look hard enough, you can find things that do make you a found hero. I mean, you just have to look.
Right.
But they really are. If you keep an eye out, there is a lot of stuff out there.
Right.
So people have to outdo themselves now? Would you still be publishing shopping lists and love letters?
Certainly. And I think the thing is that truth is far stranger than fiction. You know, anything that people are going to make up is just not going to be as interesting as all the bizarreness that we find every day. You know, the things that you can just find that are naturally a part of people's lives, the real notes that people write out and leave behind.
You've published, I saw, pages from a diary from November 22nd, 1963.
Yeah.
I'm going to judge by the handwriting. It was a young woman,
yeah,
a young girl.
I think it's a young girl.
Who was writing there and writing. It was history in the making from her perspective.
It's
the president
remarkable.
Was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days later, the assassinator, I think she said, has been assassinated.
Yeah,
Lee
it's
Harvey
pretty remarkable.
And she was getting the name wrong, but it was history in the making.
Yeah, and you know, something like that is it's a historical event that we can all understand and relate to our understanding of history. But all of these things are documenting humanity. You know, even if it's not regarding something that you may have heard of. You know, when you're picking these things up off the ground, you're really rescuing them from oblivion because these are all beautiful expressions of people's lives and of their characters and of the way they live.
So
and,
unselfconscious.
Right.
That it's really honest.
Yeah.
There's an example in here, too, of something that was not picked up on a street, but in the waters off of, I think, the west coast of Florida. And it was a bottle. It was a message in a bottle in here. And it turned out to be, 16, 17 years after this second grader had put it in the bottle from, I guess he was visiting from Ohio.
Yeah.
And tucked the message in the bottle.
Yeah.
And then it was found. And then the story evolved in the local newspaper that they were trying to track him down. But he had passed away as a 21-year-old.
Yes, yeah.
But the message, I think it was found on the anniversary of his death, and his mother, his stepmom, really, they got in touch with her about that.
We've encountered a few things that are aged in Boston just about a month ago. Someone gave us a letter that they had found tucked into a little box buried underground, and they had found it 10 or 12 years ago, and they hadn't opened it. They never opened the letter. Imagine that sort of
self-restraint. Curiosity would just kill me.
And that was long before Found Magazine existed. So then they actually brought it to the show and they opened it right there in front of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty cool. It was very early 90s-esque.
Yeah.
There are some very moving notes too. A lot of the found shows that we're doing are very humorous, but a few of the things that Peter shares are very moving, very poignant, and sometimes really sad. Like they can be very.
And on the other hand, some other things that have been sent in would be the panhandling signs.
You know, yes.
That people stand up with.
Those are terrific. That's one of my favorites.
I'm looking at one here that says, "So broke, I can't afford a bigger sign."
That's the best one. And it's a tiny little cardboard sign. It's like 6 inches by 6 inches. It's so small.
Well, that makes the point, doesn't it?
So broke, I can't afford a bigger piece of cardboard.
And a lot of these notes, you know, they are funny. They're really humorous. But at the same time, it's really tragic, you know. I mean, because these signs are something that we can recognize so easily, you know, people, because there are people who are struggling economically all over the country. And so these signs are really a part of their lives and thus a part of our lives. It's something we can relate to easily. And that's both funny and sad, you know, and a lot of the notes have both of those characteristics.
Well, I mentioned at the start that this has become a small industry, a cottage industry that might have gone beyond. You've got, as you said, 30 plus thousand subscribers to the magazine.
Yeah, the limo's waiting outside.
So are you going to continue with the magazine and the effort online? Because that's being updated constantly.
Yeah, there's a great website put together by a guy named Jason Bittner, who helps my brother put together the magazine. He's another operative, and he lives in Chicago. So the website is foundmagazine.com, and that's a great website, which is continually updated. And, yeah, we are going to continue with the magazine. Issue 4 will probably come out sometime between March and May. There's some other plans in the works. That I,
and there's a show tonight.
And in the very near future, there's
show
a show tonight
in Chapel Hill.
In Chapel Hill at the Cave.
That's right, and it's 8 o'clock tonight.
It's at 8 o'clock. I don't have the address off the top of my head, but
well, it's on Franklin Street.
Yeah, yeah.
As it's always been for Time Eternal. Yeah.
And all the information about our tour is also on the website at foundmagazine.com.
Well, great. Well, as we mentioned, you, Peter, have been making songs as well as Devin has, and we're going to hear from one of those in a moment. But I'll just say goodbye. Thank you for being with us
thanks,
today.
Thanks so much, Melinda.
Peter Rothbart and Devin Sproul, who are on tour with a book. It's called Found, the Best Lost, Tossed, and Forgotten Items from Around the World. And just ahead, we have some wise words about Krispy Kreme and archival tape of a musical tour from the 1960s. Let's go out right now with a song Peter Rothbart wrote. It was based on a letter that was written on stationery from the Abel Glass Company in Sunnyvale, California, and submitted to Found Magazine.
California, I can offer up my room. Oh, the light is bad and the phone is dead, but I'll be here with you. When you cut away these words I write, well, I hope you're safe and in a place where...
This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Just a year ago, Krispy Kreme was being held up as a corporate success story. But the Winston-Salem-based donut maker has had a series of bad breaks and bad decisions that have put it in some trouble. There's also a more recent failing, but commentator Justin Catanoso says that ought to be separated from the company's other problems.
It's time to give Krispy Kreme a break. A small one, just this one time, but a break just the same. The donut maker that could do no wrong has been on a losing streak. Its stock price has plummeted, key executives have bolted, the Atkins diet is killing sales, and the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating whether Krispy Kreme mishandled certain franchise acquisitions. All those issues are fair game for investors to scrutinize. So when Krispy Kreme said recently that it had closed a 2-year-old store in Greensboro because of weak sales, the critics were out again, questioning whether this was yet another sign of corporate incompetence and financial instability. Not this time, with this store. If anything, Krispy Kreme deserves credit for trying to do the right thing, even in the face of what it knew to be long odds. In 2002, executives understood that demographically, 2 stores in Greensboro were plenty for a market that size, but the existing stores were both on the highly developed west side of town. On the east side, Greensboro's traditional black community, redevelopment was trying to take root. A new shopping center was opening on East Market Street. The shopping center's developer, the Reverend Michael King, was a powerful and charismatic figure in the community. He believed Krispy Kreme could spark a renaissance in East Greensboro. Company executives liked that idea. They knew the project was risky. They even called it an act of faith. But 2 years ago, everything Krispy Kreme touched seemed to turn to gold. Even though the financial prospects for the location seemed modest, the social contribution was potentially significant. So the company signed on with Michael King and agreed to make him the first minority owner of a Krispy Kreme franchise, giving King's nonprofit a 51% stake in the new store. Critics can argue whether Krispy Kreme executives should have foreseen the impact of the Atkins craze on donut sales, but they were clearly blindsided by the person Michael King turned out to be. For years, King ran a nonprofit development company called Project Homestead in Greensboro. He received millions of dollars in federal and local funds to build homes for low-income families. He was seen as a hero among blacks and wielded enormous influence at City Hall. As an example, King received $500,000 in grants from the city to build the shopping center in which Krispy Kreme would be located. But Michael King turned out to be an unscrupulous businessman. A series of investigative stories last year in the Greensboro News and Record revealed the depth of King's corruption. Time and again, King appeared to use taxpayers' money for personal gain. The news got worse with allegations of personal improprieties. As public support for him and his nonprofit eroded, King took his own life last year, a few weeks before Christmas. As for the Krispy Kreme on East Market Street, well, the store never sold enough donuts to justify the investment. This time, it wasn't the Atkins diet. It just wasn't a viable location. Put simply, Krispy Kreme executives trusted a man who fooled far more people who knew him far better. They seemed to believe that King's charisma could overcome the location's inherent weaknesses. In hindsight, it appears that corporate beneficence won out over cold financial calculations. Mostly, though, this is a sad story of dashed dreams, at a lot of levels. Yet the closing has gotten lumped in with all the other bad news plaguing the donut maker these days. It shouldn't. So go easy on Krispy Kreme, at least in this one instance. The company tried to do the right thing in East Greensboro. It just didn't work out.
Justin Catanoso is executive editor of the Triad Business Journal, and he contributes to the State of Things periodically from the Greensboro studios of WFDD. At the Southern Folklife Collection at the University of North Carolina, there are collections of old sound recordings, and that's what archivist Alan Meredith goes through. Recently, she came across tapes from the Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project. This was a musical tour made up of black and white musicians who performed together on the same stage and traveled throughout the South beginning in the late 60s. They continued this through the 1980s. The project was founded by Anne Romaine, who passed away 9 years ago today, and Bernice Johnson Reagan, who is best known for her leadership of the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Although some of the recordings hiss and may be a little bit difficult to make out, Alan Meredith was impressed with the way they captured a certain historical energy in the South. When Alan brought the recordings to the attention of Bernice Johnson Reagan, she was transported to that era of change. Alan asked Bernice Johnson Reagan to recall the first time she met Anne Romaine.
I was in my house in Atlanta, Georgia, and somebody knocked on my door. I opened the door, and there was this short white woman about my height. She told me she wanted to start a tour, and she wanted the tour to be of black and white singers from the South. And did I know how to do it? And I said, yes, I know how to do it. Would I help her? I said, okay. So Anne Romaine and I organized the first tour. She called white institutions she knew, and I called black institutions I knew. And it was the first interracial tour of musicians in the South.
Sing it with me. You better come on in the mighty dew. Come on. Because it's going to be raining.
In the midst of racial upheaval in the South, Anne Romaine and Bernice Johnson Reagan assembled a cast of black and white musicians. They called their grassroots effort the Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project.
I just wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters.
That's Anne Romaine, who was interviewed by Bruce Stewart in 1980.
And set up this month-long tour, and we had Reverend Carter, Bernice got Reverend Carter Brown, the Blind Street Singer from New York, Georgia, Mabel Hillary, who was a member of the Georgia Sea Island Singers at that time, black blues singer, Teddy West, who was a mountain daughter of a radical organizer from and poet from North Georgia. We traveled around the South in this Volkswagen bus.
You better come on into my kitchen, cause it's gonna be raining out.
Anne Romaine was born in Atlanta, but was raised in rural North Carolina near Gastonia with her grandparents who worked in the cotton mill. Throughout her adult life, Romaine was a quintessential activist, working for civil rights and social justice. As a songwriter, she penned The Ballad of Gary Tyler and Georgia Cotton Woman. And as a historian, she taught at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Here is Anne leading We're Gonna Fight Back at the 1976 Southern Folk Festival in Tallahassee, Florida.
All right, we'd like to do a song now that I wrote last fall at a real historic conference in East Dubuque, Mississippi, where 300 workers, black and white workers from different parts of the South, gathered and talked about the economic crisis and how poor people were having to deal with it. We're having a hard time trying to make ends meet. The light in the tunnel, Lord, I just can't see. But we're gonna fight back.
Hear what I say.
We're gonna fight back.
Hey, out of my way.
When the people get together.
The Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project took their music and their message to colleges, prisons, and a multitude of citizen groups across the southern states. Co-founder Bernice Johnson Reagan describes the underlying significance of the tour.
It was a program about the South. And when you look at black and white music of the South, they did not observe the racial boundaries that either the slavery period or the period of segregation instituted for the people. So if you would look at songs, they would cross over and they would be shared. And so we thought we could actually demonstrate musically that if you look at the music or at the culture, there were a lot of things that moved back and forth, and there were no hard fences.
Take the power from the rich man. My sister killed a jailer. Joanne's skin is black. She would have been on death row, but people fought back. Yeah, the people fought back.
When this integrated group traveled throughout the segregated South, they were often met by opposition. Alice Gerard joined the tour in the early 1970s. She recalls a time when the van broke down and she and Ann went to find something to eat at a local diner.
Johnny Shines, who's this, was this blues musician, black blues musician, came, and he was on the tour with us, and he came up the sidewalk and happened to see us in there and came in, and the guy came out from behind the bar and he said, I'll make the sandwiches and you can eat them here, but he'll have to take his out. Ann got up in this guy. She walked up to him, and she was like 5 feet tall, and he was this big, burly kind of guy. And she got right in his face, and she shook her finger at him. She said, that's against the law. She said, I'll have the FBI in your ass so fast you won't know what to do. And she was livid. And he went in the back and got a broom and came out, and he had it raised over his head like he was going to hit her with it.
When people get together, there ain't no kind of weather. Prepare this place apart, or make a brand new start. But we're going to take the power, kind of one more time.
Later, they traveled to newly desegregated public schools around the South, where they encountered still more resistance to their message. Bernice Johnson Reagan explains.
In the public school system in Atlanta, Georgia, it was interesting because the schools had been integrated by the courts. So into those classrooms, there were black and white students, but they were forced into that situation. And then we were going into those classrooms, and it would be black and white singers doing these songs. And I still remember this white girl reaching over and holding hands, because we would always hold hands, with this black student. And I wondered and prayed for her because there was hostility in the room.
By the late 1970s, the school program was a major feature of the Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project. Here's Jane Sapp teaching a traditional African song at Druid High School in Tuscaloosa, Alabama in 1977.
Whatever these next few periods are, all of us here together in this room, we will make music together. And I'm willing to help you out because your song is my song. Boyeza, kusasa, boyeza. Boyeza.
Being on the tour was a life-altering experience for many of the musicians.
There were great times on the road, and there were hard times on the road, and it's easy to look back on it and realize what a powerful experience the whole thing was and how fortunate we were to be able to go on these tours and just be bouncing along a back road in a van with Doc Boggs and Elizabeth Cotton.
Again, Alice Gerard.
It was consciously decided that we would never segregate. I mean, if it might be easier for Bessie Jones and Jane Sapp to travel in the same car, but we always wanted it to be integrated. And when we went into a restaurant, we were always very conscious of, you know, sitting mixed at a table. It raised my consciousness to a much higher level. And, you know, Doc Boggs and Elizabeth Cotton struck up this really strong friendship, and he was very courteous with her. He called her Miss Cotton, you know, and he'd help her in and out of the van, and she would hold his flask of whiskey in her purse.
I'm Elizabeth Cotton from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Y'all ever heard that before?
Anne Romaine continued to lead the Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project, organizing concerts and festivals throughout the South until the early 1980s, and always on a shoestring budget. She died unexpectedly on October 26, 1995, at the age of 52. Bernice Johnson Reagan remembers the last day she spent with Anne in the hospital.
We spent the whole day together, and at the end of the day, we were alone, and Anne had this songbook, and she gave me the songbook, and she made me sing. And I would stop to do something. She would say, "Sing, woman." And so I sang all of these songs. And it was such a blessing that I got to do that because she died the next day.
I will meet you on the other shore.
Bernice Johnson Reagan acknowledges the personal and cultural significance of Anne's leadership.
I think the project was important, and I think it was especially important because it was created by two women, one black, one white. I think it was important because one of those women carried it on for a quarter of a century. It was a major piece of her life. Major.
All of Anne's concerts ended with the old slave song, Goodbye. Here's a version by Reverend Pearlie Brown, a charismatic performer who Alice Gerard claims always led it the best.
The Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project collection is part of a preservation initiative that's been funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Alan Meredith is an independent radio producer and archivist in the Triangle.